Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're originating from KSKA here in Anchorage. Today, my guest is radiation oncologist Dr. Carabucci, and our topic is the use of radiation in the treatment of cancers. You can reach us with your questions and comments by calling us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Bucci has been practicing radiation oncology for about 8 years. She's a specialist in thoracic and head and neck cancers being treated with radiation therapy. Her primary training was at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's had some work responsibilities at MD Anderson in Houston and the University of California in San Francisco before recently joining physicians here in Anchorage. Kara, it's a pleasure to have you on Line One.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Those of the listeners who listen to the program know I like to start with some definitions and basic understandings. So I think I'd like to start by just kind of talking about where we are now and understanding what cancer is, and then we'll move on to some of these ideas about radiation and what that is and what it can do and what it can't do. So tell us what we need to know about cancer.
As far as what cancer is exactly?
Yeah.
I usually explain cancer as kind of a confused cell. Mm-hmm. If you remember any high school biology, remember that metaphase, anaphase, mitosis stuff?
Yeah.
So when cells split, they divide, and like one cell becomes two, and the cells all talk to each other. So when a cell divides, one of those cells eventually has to divide, or one cell somewhere, or has to die. One cell somewhere has to divide. Otherwise, every time your cells divided, you would get twice as big. Cancer cells have lost the ability to talk to each other. So when they divide, they're not talking to the other cells, so one of them doesn't die. They divide more often than they need to. And so what you end up with is a hunk of tissue, which is a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
So they've lost the ability to talk to other cells. They divide too often and without dying. And the other piece of information they've lost is where they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a lung cell that leaves the lung, gets stuck in another organ and starts growing there,
mm-hmm.
Which is a metastasis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cancer essentially is cells that are confused. They've forgotten how to do what they're supposed to do.
And basically all cancers, and I'm asking you kind of to tell me I'm wrong if I am, they're now thought to be, it's basically all a genetic problem. It's the DNA has been injured or is not reacting appropriately to lead to these changes that we call cancer.
Right. Genetic in the sense that it happens on a gene level or at the level of DNA, yes. Genetic, not necessarily hereditary.
Sure. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, there could be some hereditary issues that may lead to increase in cancer, like the gene BRCA, for example. So there's those reasons. But then there are other reasons. There's environmental exposures, age. All these cells are constantly having to reproduce themselves, so there's a lot of remaking DNA, and that causes errors.
Exactly. Every time the DNA doubles, again, for this whole mitosis things, there's the potential for errors. And one of the most likely areas for this is there's actually a gene, a piece of the DNA, that controls for error repair. And when that piece of the DNA goes bad, more errors can accumulate.
Mm-hmm.
And when a very specific sequence of errors shows up, then the cell can still live, but get sticky and stick in other organs or grow too often.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's genetic in the sense that it is a DNA.
One more mm-hmm. question that is my understanding, and I got this understanding from reading The Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee recently. Very, very good book, in my opinion. But at the end, he really brings us kind of up to date as it was maybe a year ago, and is that the thought now is that each of these things that characterize cancers, this inability to stop its growth, the inability to talk to each other cells, the ability to make its own blood supply, the ability to decide it's going to move over and be in another part of the body that are all different genetic changes. They're all different errors, so that it may take multiple years for all these different changes to accumulate to really lead to bad cancers. I'm maybe not saying that correctly, but that was an interesting insight that
That it may take a while, or again, that it's just a very specific set of errors that leads to a cancer. Mm-hmm. If you think of all the potential, DNA is incredibly long, and if you think of all the potential errors that could happen, most of them are not going to lead to a cancer. Mm-hmm. Most of them are either going to lead to a cell that's confused in some other way, or that simply can't live. To have such a specific set of errors that it's not only capable of still living, but living in such a way that it becomes cancer is really incredibly unlikely. And it takes multiple hits or errors over a length of time for a cell to become that cancer cell, yes. And not every cancer is the same.
And that would explain why one of the biggest risk factors for having cancer is being older. Over time, you have more and more and more likelihood that these changes are the right change is going to accumulate.
Or the more that cells divide, the more likelihood the more likely they are to pick up these errors.
Okay.
So the more replications they go through, possibly.
Mm-hmm. So it makes sense as we have an aging population that we may see more in the way of cancers that are not necessarily environmentally induced.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we're going to talk about radiation, and the radiation that you use in your everyday work is part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and I'd like to just go over that again in a little bit of detail so we can understand the characteristics of that and where the radiation that you use, the wavelengths you use, where it fits on that spectrum.
That's a great question. Radiation is kind of hard to understand because you can't really see it. Mm-hmm. It works like light because it's, again, part of the spectrum. The electromagnetic spectrum goes from radio waves at the low end to high-energy X-rays and gamma rays at the high end, with visible light somewhere in between. The main difference between high-energy radiation, or X-rays that we use, is that they're ionizing, or they're high enough energy to actually knock an electron out of orbit. And that's what gives them the capability to both cure a cancer and cause one. When radiation enters tissue or hits a strand of DNA, by knocking that electron out of orbit, they can actually cause a DNA strand break. Healthy cells can repair that strand break from day to day, but cancer cells can't. For whatever made them become confused in the first place, they've generally lost the ability to repair more errors also. And a course of radiation is typically fractionated, or a little bit every day, 5 days a week over a course of around 6 weeks. And the reason we do that, or give a little bit every day, is to give healthy cells the chance to repair these new DNA strand breaks caused by the radiation. So after 30 treatments, the cancer cells have accumulated so many DNA strand breaks from the radiation that they can't live anymore. They just fall apart.
Okay. Just quickly back to this spectrum. So the low energies, very long wavelengths like radio waves, to our knowledge, don't cause any significant problems. Once we get into light, we start getting these shorter waves with a little bit more energy. Then we get into ultraviolet, which can cause some effects on DNA, maybe not the really bad things we're talking about. Then the next layer of, as we identified, of radiation becomes X-rays. And then there's the gamma rays, which are really not good for health.
Yeah, X-rays and gamma rays, there's actually some overlap with. Uh-huh. The definition is kind of mobile there. But yes, higher energy than visible light is ultraviolet, which we know can cause skin cancers. They're still not ionizing, though. They still don't have enough energy to actually knock this electron out of orbit.
Okay.
But radio waves are very, very low energy and don't cause any DNA damage at all. Lower energies of visible light, anything less than ultraviolet, and radio waves, microwaves, have no ability to cause cancer.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection, and I've gotten deep into understanding these basic principles. So let me remind you, if you've got questions or comments today about radiation therapy for cancer, this is the place and the time to call. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. As we move through this, really a big part of the program, we'll be talking about some of the newer uses of radiation, and particularly something called stereotactic body radiation, which Dr. Carabucci, my guest today, is particularly well known for and is practicing those therapies. And we're going to be talking about when and why and why not you might want to use that kind of therapy. So those are the kind of where we're heading here. You said, Dr. Bucci, that the radiation X-rays can be used both to treat and they might cause cancer. Can you delineate a little bit the differences in how those two things happen with radiation? Why does radiation cause cancer in one situation and treat cancer in another?
Largely, it's dependent on how much is aimed and or how much is given and over what period of time. Mm-hmm. So therapeutic radiation is a large amount of high energy radiation specifically focused at a tumor, and it's enough to cause enough DNA damage to make the cancer cells die. Mm-hmm. Carcinogenesis from radiation, or cancer induced by radiation, is usually from smaller amounts of radiation and takes a very long period of time and is much less likely from any amount of radiation. So generally you only see cancer from radiation over a large population because it's so much less likely. If you have a large number of people exposed to a very small amount of radiation over a very long period of time, you may see a few more cancers than you would have seen otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's the history? How long have X-rays been used in cancer therapy? Kind of bring us up to date on the history of this procedure.
So X-rays were first discovered in 1895 by a German physicist who was working with vacuum tubes. And I think within a year, somebody was using them to try to treat a stomach cancer. It's not known if that was successful or not, but X-rays were successfully used for skin cancer as early as the 1920s. Obviously, radiation has evolved drastically since then. In the 1920s, people were just taking radium or radioactive metal and holding it up against skin cancer. Since then, we've developed the ability to measure radiation a lot better, discover how much radiation is necessary for which types of cancer. Radiation is now controlled by software and is made by machines, so it's highly regulated now and is continually evolving, actually has rapidly evolved within the last 5, 10, 20 years to limit the amount of radiation that goes to normal tissue and increase the amount of radiation that actually goes to the tumor. But man-made X-rays have been around since 1895.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So initially, like there is with many therapeutic efforts, there's were a lot of problems, and we've all heard that people who worked with radiation and radium and certain chemicals early in the history of understanding X-rays, which, as you said earlier, are invisible. We had some bad outcomes. There's been some bad outcomes with medical use. How do we go about assuring patients that we are better at decreasing long-term risks? I'm sure that's what a lot of patients must want to know.
Yeah, so first, what you're probably referring to is, several things. One, early on, Marie Curie discovered radium in 1896 and later died of leukemia.
Right.
You may also be referring to, within the last year or two, there's been some press for several radiation accidents that were widely publicized in the popular press. And accidents with therapeutic radiation, when they happen, they're rare, but it's like a surgeon operating on the wrong side of the brain. When it happens, it's very big news. With each radiation treatment, there's a lot of QA or quality assurance that goes into every patient's radiation plan. There's a team of people involved in each patient's care. Most of it's behind the scenes. But there's not just the physician involved. There's a very heavy role for medical physics, as well as dosimetry and radiation therapy. So there's about 10 people involved in each single patient's radiation plan. And the quality assurance that that is involved is there's about an hour per day per radiation machine that's spent in the morning when we turn the machines on to make sure that what is coming out of the machine is actually what we think is coming out of the machine. It's physically measured each day. Again, because you can't see it. But the short answer is you're right. There's an enormous amount of safety and quality assurance. As far as how patients can be sure of that, that's a more difficult question because really all patients see is the physician. Mm-hmm. And the role of physics, again, is enormous. I know I'm lucky to work at a center that has fabulous physicists. This is probably a good time to acknowledge our physicists. They're Darwin Zellmer and Noah Arvidsson, and our dosimetrist is Sue Wirth. They're all phenomenal, and they do a large amount of the radiation treatment planning. But the quality assurance is there's testing, maintenance, and operability of the equipment. There's education, training, and supervision of staff, and patient positioning, process of care for the treatment planning. It's really quite extensive.
Is there state and or federal oversight on what happens in radiation oncologists' offices?
It's evolving. It's evolving. There's a national board called the ACR, which is the American College of Radiology, that can accredit freestanding units, but the accreditation process is relatively easy and doesn't do a lot of QA oversight. And most physicians' offices are really in charge of their own QA.
How about what do we know about long-term effects? I know this is a tough question. It seems like we've been doing radiation therapy for cancers for a long time, but not all that long, so it's hard to say we've got 20, 30, 40 years follow-up on patients. People ask about immunizations. What do we know? Well, there's, you know, I was one of the first people to get polio vaccine, and I'm still alive, so we don't know, you know, a lifetime outcome. What do we know, and how do we know generally the long-term safety of this these kinds of treatments?
That's a great question. All of the cancers that radiation is indicated for, is the indications are from randomized trials. So the long-term follow-up comes from these trials, and if the that outcomes include the long-term follow-up data, which include the side effect data. So this is a good time to point out that there is a standard recommendation for all cancer by stage, which is available to treatment available to patients on websites like nccn.org. If radiation is recommended for a cancer, either in combination with or as opposed to surgery or chemotherapy, it's based on a trial that showed a benefit at 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, and that was taking any possible long-term side effects into account. So there can be some side effects from radiation based on the type of tumor that we're treating, the amount of radiation, and the body site. But that's included in the recommendation.
Yeah, and it's like any cancer, any treatment, there's a risk of treatment, which needs to be discussed with side effects, and risk of not treating, which has to all go into the equation. And that's where individualized interactions with patients really becomes important. However, I want to not skirt over this website, the nccn.org, which we are putting up on our website for people who want to go to. And you're telling me this is a site where patients can go with a specific diagnosis of cancer to see what the national recommendations are for treatment.
Yes, there's a site for providers and also a site for patients. It's NCCN.org for patients. So patients should not have the experience of going to six different providers and getting six different recommendations for their cancers.
Mm-hmm.
There are national recommendations that are standardized for mm-hmm. each type of cancer by site and by stage.
Mm-hmm. But things can get individualized depending on a person's individual age, sex, other medical problems, and so forth.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. That should be clear to patients, though. If mm-hmm. they're not getting a standard recommendation, they should be able to understand why.
Okay.
I think patients often have the experience of going on the internet and getting confusing information or information that is a lot scarier than it needs to be. And often even incorrect information. Mm-hmm. So I think it's helpful for patients to know where to go where they can get reliable information. Mm-hmm. And that's one website where I know the information there is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Also the American Cancer Society and ASTRO, which is the American Society for Therapeutic Radiation and Oncology.
And for those mm-hmm. who are listening, all of those mm-hmm. sites are up on our website as of this time. What else? Anything else we need to talk about from a just general understanding of how radiation works, side effects, concerns, and so forth, before we get into some specific therapies? Have we touched everything you think that we need to?
We're extremely cautious about possible long-term side effects. We talk mm-hmm. about them at length before patients mm-hmm. start. I think often to often so extensively that we end up scaring patients more than necessary.
uh-huh.
The benefit obviously outweighs the risks of radiation.
Right.
Otherwise, we wouldn't recommend
right.
it.
Right, right.
But some radiation side effects don't show up for mm-hmm. years, mm-hmm. you know, 10, 20, 30 mm-hmm. years. And at that point, you know, we think it's a good thing if patients have made it out, you know, 20 yeah. years from their cancer treatment.
Right.
And if the threat of cancer
the treatment
faded,
wouldn't have been recommended if the odds are you're going to live 20 or 30 years in the first place. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying. It's the logic that goes on.
Right, exactly. If it's mm-hmm. the treatment was successful, if mm-hmm. you know, if you're 20 years out and having a side effect that is generally an annoyance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. My guest is Dr. Carabucci, and we're talking about radiotherapy for cancers. We're going to talk about some very specific uses, but we're going through the general ideas and general concerns at this point and general mechanisms. So if you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, before we move on, then, what are some of the common side effects early and long-term that people need to be aware of and that you might talk to patients about?
Radiation side effects are generally divided into two different types. There are acute side effects that happen during the course of radiation, which generally go away when the radiation is over. And there are late-term side effects, which can show up months or years later, which are less common, but are generally permanent. So acute side effects are generally things like a skin reaction in the area where the radiation goes in, occasionally fatigue, and these clear up. The acute side effects are also dependent on the body site that we're treating. All of radiation side effects are site-specific and limited only to the area that we're treating. And late-term side effects can be tissue fibrosis, or sometimes the skin where the radiation goes gets a little bit thicker, or the consistency can change.
So it's kind of a response to injury, kind of.
Right, exactly.
Scarring, but maybe that's too strong of a word sometimes.
No, it's exactly like scarring. It's mm-hmm. it's not quite like a scar you get with a cut, but it's mm-hmm. like a subclinical scarring.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And those are short-term?
The scarring can be late-term.
Late, okay.
Mm-hmm. Short-term is more like a sunburn that clears up in a few weeks after the radiation's over.
Okay. Other long-term side effects?
We always talk about the risk of second cancers. Mm-hmm. It's remote, mm-hmm. unlikely, but it's always a possibility.
Yeah. It's been noticed with all kinds of treatments, not just radiation therapy, that there might be an increased risk. And the question comes up, is it due to something wrong with the patient that he gets the second or a third, or is it the treatment? And that's very difficult to sort out.
Right, is whatever made you get the first cancer.
Yep. Have something to do with the next one.
Right.
Sure. Okay. One other thing that keeps, and I know people maybe wanted me to get to this, but the specifics, but another thing I think is very important for people to understand is something we talked about before we came on the air, and that is the recognition that there's just almost truly exponentially growth in the amounts of information. So that when I talked to a physical therapist a week ago, I was very much impressed of what I did not understand about some aspects of physical therapy, and yet we're both trying to do and help the same patient. So I asked you before the program, what about oncologists? What about people who are dealing with cancer? Has the information load gotten to such a point where it's difficult for an oncologist to know that this is today the best approach for this particular cancer? And I think your answer is reassuring to listeners to how we resolve that issue.
Right, and what we talked about was multidisciplinary care.
Right.
That for every cancer patient, they generally see a radiation oncologist, a surgical oncologist, and a medical oncologist. And the three of us all talk and come up with a treatment plan together. And there are often tumor boards where, in addition to these three types of oncologists, there are radiologists and pathologists discussing the type of cancer as well, so that there's a three-pronged approach to every type of cancer, so that a patient doesn't come to a radiation oncologist and be told they should have radiation, and go to a medical mm-hmm. oncologist and be told they should have chemo, and go to a surgeon and be told they should have surgery. The three of us together come up with a combined approach that, again, should be the same from every doctor wherever they go. But this term multidisciplinary is really big in cancer at any cancer center.
And then you also mentioned that the NCCN.org also has a website for physicians. So I'm assuming part of the reason for that is so that a physician faced with a patient with a certain diagnosis might be able to quickly look and see, as of today's date, what the most likely or recommended treatments are for that particular cancer.
Exactly. And that's based on the latest trials or the latest evidence. Mm-hmm. The recommendations change as new studies come out showing if one treatment is better and why.
Mm-hmm. And those studies, as you applied, are very rigorous studies that are done in multiple universities, oftentimes because you need to get enough patients. It may involve several major facilities trying to keep track of information on treatment and side effects and outcomes on patients. And then that all is published and looked at, and then decisions are made by experts in the area based on that information, the newest. Okay. Well, thanks very much for bearing with me. I thought that was really helpful. And what we're going to do, I think, now is I'll take the usual break that we take, and we'll come back and start talking about stereotactic body radiation therapy. We'll define that and get into some specific uses. And we've also had an email I want to address. So let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails as we talk with Dr. Carabucci regarding the use of radiation for cancer therapy. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. And today we're talking about radiation being used to treat cancers. And my guest is radiation oncologist Dr. Kara Bucci. She's recently joined the radiation therapy team at Alaska Regional Hospital. We'll talk about the locations of these facilities and what else is available in the state, perhaps in just a short period of time. But want to remind listeners, if you have comments, this is the time to call in or email or give us your questions. And our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And the usual reminder, if you're listening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, and we won't be able to answer any questions at that time. So, Kara, my understanding is your real area of expertise and experience is stereotactic body radiation therapy, so also known as SBRT, if we fall into using that shortened form. But tell us exactly what that is and what its purposes are.
So the word stereotactic just means that you're using a 3D coordinate system for better localization. So it doesn't necessarily apply to radiation. You can have a stereotactic breast biopsy or stereotactic surgery. Mm-hmm. So it's really just a localization term. For radiation, there are two terms that are tossed around. One is stereotactic radiosurgery, which has nothing to do with surgery. There are no knives or cutting involved. And the other is stereotactic body radiotherapy. And the difference between those two depends on the number of treatments. Stereotactic radiosurgery is one big treatment of radiation, and stereotactic body radiotherapy is up to 5 treatments. And when we use stereotactic radiosurgery, or SRS, it's usually in the brain. And SBRT, which is up to 5 treatments, is usually elsewhere in the body. We like the acronym, so I'm going to stick with the SRS and the SBRT.
Okay.
And again, conventional radiation is usually 5 days a week for approximately 6 weeks, 4 to 8, depending on the type of tumor or the body site. So SRS and SBRT are very different because they're just these, 1 to 5 really big treatments of radiation. And the goal of these treatments is they're ablative. The target that we're aiming at, the goal is just to completely destroy it, as opposed to with fractionated radiation, where we're really selecting out the healthy cells from the cancer cells by letting the healthy cells repair their DNA every day. We generally think of most cancer cells, or most tumors, as having kind of tentacles that spread out into normal tissue. And we're trying to, kill the cancer cells that we can't necessarily see while protecting the normal tissue. With SRS and SBRT, we're trying to just completely destroy the tumor that we see. So it's not a good choice for a tumor that has anything inside that we're trying to preserve.
Mm-hmm. You talked about earlier, for example, a prostate cancer where the urethra runs right through the middle of it. You don't want to do that.
No. There are some early studies looking at stereotactic for prostate cancer, and with short follow-up, it looks like it may be safe, but the general recommendation is to only do that on study. Uh-huh. So that's the standard for prostate is still 35 to 40 days.
How do you go about marking? So what I'm hearing is you're trying to get rid of all the tumor. How do you know where the margins of the tumor might be?
Imaging. That's where we trust our radiology friends.
Okay.
So CTs, MRIs, PET scans.
Mm-hmm.
And we take these images and fuse them with treatment planning or mm-hmm. the scan that we do to calculate the radiation and then mm-hmm. get the patient in the right place. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of fusion software involved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. And what is a PET scan exactly for our listeners?
That's a great question. I know there's a lot of animals and CAT scans, PET scans. Everyone asks if there's a dog scan. A PET scan is where you take radioactive sugar uh-huh. and inject it.
Uh-huh.
And that goes to any site in the body that's metabolically active or cells that are dividing. So any site of inflammation will take this up, and you can see it on your detector. The brain takes it up because your brain is active. The heart takes it up often because your heart is active. But cancer also will take up this radioactive sugar. Mm-hmm. So then when you take an image, we see the heart and the brain and sites of inflammation. But if there's something that's not supposed to be there that we're not expecting, typically, that's the cancer.
Okay. We have a phone call I want to take. Roger, you're on line mm-hmm. one. What can we do for you?
Hey, how are you doing there, Doc? I appreciate you taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I got a son that didn't have insurance. He had a infection, and his ear had been bothering him for about 9 years. It got all inflamed and stuff. I sent him to my dermatologist, who took a biopsy, and it turned out to be melanoma. He had, then I called one of the cancer centers here in town and got him a pro bono appointment for radiation treatment. And he lost two small tumors out of the top part of his ear. And that's been 8 months ago, and he still has no problem with that ear, which was a godsend.
Okay.
But otherwise, he'd probably be gone here for too many times.
Yeah, and melanoma's not a particularly good one. So you want to ask a question about whether or not you think how radiation plays in the treatment of melanoma?
Well, I think it worked good in his case.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure that people knew that there is places to go.
Ah, I got you.
If you don't have insurance to get treatment.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Roger. We're going to talk about that just briefly, at least the melanoma aspect. I appreciate your comments.
Okay. Have a good day and
yep.
Be safe.
Yep. Same to you.
Bye-bye.
So what about treatment of melanoma? When is radiation therapy the appropriate thing?
Rarely, actually. Mm-hmm. The standard treatment for melanoma is usually surgery, and radiation is reserved for nodal beds or mm-hmm. Areas where there are a lot of lymph nodes. If there are generally four or more lymph nodes involved, if those lymph nodes are 3 centimeters or larger, or if there's something called extracapsular extension of the lymph nodes, mm-hmm. Radiation is rarely a primary treatment for melanoma. One exception is if the melanoma has gone to the brain. Mm-hmm. If there are a limited number of areas in the brain where the melanoma has spread, then we can use actually SRS, stereotactic radiosurgery. But for a primary melanoma, radiation is rarely the only treatment. If it is used, it's in combination with surgery.
And so usually the initial treatment would be trying to surgically eradicate, at least get some idea of the depth of this as it spread, and that's where Mohs surgery comes in?
Rarely Mohs for melanoma, because in melanoma you need a decent chunk of normal tissue surrounding the tumor to make sure that you got it all. Mm-hmm. One very promising thing in melanoma actually is a targeted therapy. Something you'll hear a lot about with cancer mm-hmm. is targeted therapies or mm-hmm. chemotherapies that have been made specifically for a tumor based on what they look like genetically. Mm-hmm. And one that came out recently for melanoma is called, I know I'm going to pronounce it wrong, it's like ipilimumab or something.
Yeah.
It's an antibody, but it
right.
showed a survival advantage in melanoma. It's very exciting news for melanoma.
So mm-hmm. these kind of cancers you're alluding mm-hmm. to are immunologic treatments where an antibody is developed outside of the person, which is designed to go in and hone in on that cancer and do serious damage and hopefully kill it completely. Yep, and it's a huge area of development of immunotherapy. All right, so let's get back to the stereotactic body radiation therapy, which is your expertise. And you've told us a little bit about how we identify the borders, how we know what we're going for, and we're trying to completely ablate it, the surgery. So what are the cancer? What kind of cancers are best suited for this kind of approach?
In the body, it's typically lung, liver, or tumors that have started somewhere else and spread to one of these sites. And in the brain, it's typically tumors that also have started somewhere else and spread, provided that they're controlled elsewhere in the body and there is only a limited number of tumors in the brain.
And why is that the case? Just because those are areas where you can do ablative therapy and not cause any big problems?
Exactly. and because of those tentacles. We're worried about the tentacles.
Okay.
And if there's more than a couple sites, then the risk of having disease elsewhere is high enough that you want to do more than the stereotactic.
So what kind? So there are also more than one kind of lung cancer, and there's more than one kind of liver cancer. Are those important differentiations?
Absolutely. So for lung cancer, the type of lung cancer that stereotactic would be indicated for are small tumors that have not yet spread to the lymph nodes in between the lungs that are not candidates for surgery. The primary treatment for these types of tumors, the standard, is still surgery. Where stereotactic radiation is indicated is patients who have enough other medical problems that the thoracic surgeon thinks that surgery is really not a good idea. Mm-hmm. Typically for these patients, they have either had no treatment options available or they've had a surgery that's less than ideal, like a smaller amount of lung than the surgeon would really recommend ordinarily, mm-hmm. Or they've had fractionated radiation, which is over 6 weeks. And what we found is that by doing these few really big treatments of radiation, that's much better at controlling the tumor than fractionated radiation over 6 weeks, or than a very small surgery called a wedge resection.
Mm-hmm. One of the examples of thoracic surgery that came to my mind, and I don't do this, so I may be wrong, is an elderly person who has smoked for a long time, who has emphysema and a lung cancer, so that the emphysema may put the person at such a risk for surgery that the stereotactic surgery might be the primary approach. Is that the kind of example you're talking about?
Yeah, it depends on the extent of emphysema, but Right. Possibly, yes.
Yeah.
Or other contraindications to surgery, sometimes heart disease or mm-hmm. Any other.
Besides lung cancer, you said liver cancer. There are multiple kinds of liver cancer. Do you find that the stereotactic radiation therapy is being done much more commonly for the lung cancers than the liver cancers, or is it just depend on where you are?
It does depend on referral patterns, yes. But also because primary lung tumors tend to be the indications for liver tend to be instances of tumors that start elsewhere in the gastrointestinal tract and have spread to the liver. But only in highly selected patients, mm-hmm. where there's one spot in the liver that's not amenable to surgery, and patients are doing well otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it's a more common scenario for patients to either have these small lung tumors that are not candidates for surgery. For people that have these, you know, small early lung tumors, as many as a third of them can't have surgery because of their underlying lung disease. So that is definitely more common. The other indication for stereotactic radiotherapy to the lung is for tumors like sarcoma that have spread to the lung, or for possibly GI tumors that have also spread to the lung.
The other question that came to my mind that we talked about briefly before we came on the air was the fact that even if you're going to do some radiation therapy, you need to be sure of the cell type of the cancer. That one, you got to be sure it's a cancer, and two, now it's becoming increasingly important to know more about those cells, partly because of the immunotherapy approaches that we talked about a minute ago. So it sounds like before there is radiotherapy, the stereotactic radiotherapy, there is also some kind of an attempt to get a piece of what appears to be a cancer on typical radiation workup so that we know for sure what we're dealing with.
Yeah, there's always a biopsy. Okay. To be sure that you have a cancer, you need to take a small piece of that tumor and look at it under a microscope, and the pathologist has to tell you 100% definitely that it's cancer. For you to know for sure.
Okay. And if you don't mind, walk me through, paint me a picture of what it's like to prepare a patient for this kind of procedure. I'm thinking about movement as being a problem and so forth. So how do we physically get this procedure done?
That's a great question. Movement is a big issue in radiation, mm-hmm. especially within the lung or liver where people are breathing.
Right.
So after the patient has already been diagnosed and comes to us and has all their staging scans already, the treatment planning scan for radiation is typically a CT scan where a patient is immobilized. We make kind of a mold of their body to help get them in the same position every day, and we do a CAT scan in that position. And typically for stereotactic radiation, there's kind of an extra special body mold to make sure they're totally exactly in the right place. And the CAT scan we do is, we do something called a 4D CAT scan, where we do a CAT scan with them breathing to see how far the tumor moves while they breathe, so with them breathing in and breathing out, to get the full excursion of the tumor. And we take that data set and we plan either the full motion path of the tumor or with them holding their breath, depending on how well they can hold their breath and how far the tumor moves. We plan on where to aim the radiation, and that the radiation planning takes us generally about a week or two. Mm-hmm. So the patient comes back after that treatment planning scan and is repositioned in that same mold twice a week for five times total to actually get the radiation. So what the patient sees is that they come in, they get this body mold made, mm-hmm. Then they go home for 2 weeks, then they come back five more times mm-hmm. For an hour each time. From our perspective, we take this fancy CT scan of them breathing, we fuse it with their PET scan, plan the radiation based on the tumor excursion.
Mm-hmm. Can some people hold their breath long enough that you don't have to worry about that, or is that something that just automatically is figured that there's going to be the potential for movement, so you got to control for that?
It would be gated. They hold their breath for a short period of time, and the machine kind of turns on and off as they hold their breath. Mm-hmm. And most patients who have lung tumors cannot do that.
Okay.
We would not do breath hold for most lung tumors. Okay. That is something that you can do for non-stereotactic and other body sites, but that's a whole different... It's kind of a whole different topic. So typically we treat the whole motion path for lung tumors. And when the patient actually is getting treated, there are a whole bunch of images that's taken with the patient on the table to make sure that they're in exactly the right place. It's called image-guided radiation, or IGRT.
Mm-hmm. Are there patients who just can't do this?
Rarely. There are patients mm-hmm. who can't tolerate being in exactly the same place for the mm-hmm. treatment can take up to an hour, and
okay.
there are patients who can't tolerate being in exactly mm-hmm. the same place for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, we can treat for 20 minutes and give them a break, and do another 20 minutes and give them a break, and just keep repositioning them. There are not patients whose lungs are so bad that for a small tumor we couldn't do this. There are tumors that are There are tumors that are too big for this, that patients that aren't candidates for stereotactic radiation because the tumors are too advanced, or patients whose lungs are so healthy that they're better off getting surgery. But there are not patients whose tumors that are eligible who we would not recommend this for.
When I first started looking into this as a pediatrician, I'm amazed at the technology and the advances and how fast we've gotten to the point where we're doing stereotactic radiotherapy in Anchorage, Alaska, for example. All right, and so it's not that I don't believe that that's reasonable. It's my mind goes, what in the heck has happened technologically that has allowed this to disseminate? It doesn't take much to get on the internet and look at these videos. And the reason I didn't put a link to a video is because I was thinking, things are moving so fast, maybe you don't even have to make these body molds anymore. But so you can look at videos of this. What has happened that has allowed this kind of thing, which you would think it only would be at MD Anderson or Johns Hopkins or Cornell, to be done well in lots of places throughout the United States?
Radiation is definitely a field that evolves quickly. It's not a good field for people who don't like change. As people from major centers leave and enter the community. Again, one of our physicists is also from University of Wisconsin and has a lot of experience in stereotactic. And I think he and I are both in Anchorage, which is a good setup to start doing this procedure here. The dissemination of technology comes from the people, really.
Mm-hmm.
But we are proud of being able to offer Anchorage enough treatment so that they don't have to go outside.
What is available, while it's on my mind, in the state of Alaska as far as radiation therapy? You'd mentioned beforehand that both Providence and Alaska Regional have these facilities, and that there's a facility also in Fairbanks. Are they all doing stereotactic? How is it different from each place?
There's a facility in the Valley, too.
Okay.
The ones doing stereotactic, I think Providence is doing... some in the brain. I don't believe they're doing body radiotherapy, but I think they're doing brain radiosurgery. That's it for the state, though, those four facilities. So, yeah, people in Alaska really do have to travel quite a bit.
And your organization, again, it's Alaska Radiation Therapy.
Anchorage Radiation Therapy.
Has a local office at Regional and an office in the valley where you're doing some of this, Providence, and then there's Fairbanks.
There
was a question that was on my mind, and I'm losing it, but I'll come back to it. There's an email here that I think needs to be cleared up. And this writer says, the mention of radiated, quote, sugar prompts me to ask the question about sugar in cancer. I've heard that cancer feeds aggressively on sugar. And if you cut down your intake of sugar, you can help starve nascent or active cancers. True or false?
There's no evidence supporting that. So,
yeah, it's like the idea is if you don't eat sugar, it's hard not to eat sugar. Carbohydrates are a sugar and they're part of everything. And even if you don't eat sugars, your bodies are going to make carbohydrates to use as a food source. So that's kind of a misunderstanding or a fallacy that is not true. That's not an accepted way, a proven way to treat cancer. What are other mechanisms, other things that you can do with stereotactic body radiation besides perhaps treat cancers?
There are a few benign conditions that you can use stereotactic radiation for, things like acoustic neuromas and AVMs or arteriovenous malformations in the brain. Because radiation can cause cancers, we're very careful about treating non-cancerous conditions. So currently we're not treating anything that's not cancer with stereotactic radiation. These are they're very rare conditions. If there's a need for those in Anchorage, then we'll look into treating those. Part of our mission is to provide everybody in Alaska what they need so that they don't have to go outside, so that people can get their radiation at home. But currently what we're doing with the SBRT is just cancer.
This particular email came in and said that it implies that perhaps acoustic neuromas can be treated. That's an intracranial tumor. Would you make a comment on the use of, on the treatment of acoustic neuromas and then the use of SBRT on acoustic neuromas?
Acoustic neuromas definitely can be treated with stereotactic radiation. It's not a first-line treatment.
Okay.
But they definitely can be treated effectively with stereotactic radiation.
And what is an acoustic neuroma?
It is a benign growth of a lining of a nerve around the eighth nerve.
Yeah,
the eighth cranial nerve entering the around the base of the skull.
The acoustic nerve, the nerve that which conducts our hearing impulses into our brain. So, and it's benign. So that you also mentioned that beforehand stereotactic radiosurgery is often used on brain tumors. Why that difference? Why the radiation therapy for the brain is caused something different and needs a little bit more therapy than what's going on in the lung?
To be honest, it's purely historic. When it was started in the brain, it was started by a team of neurosurgeons. So they called it radiosurgery. And it was started with just one treatment. You could do it in a couple treatments, but typically you don't need to, and it's easier to do it in one. And in the rest of the body, we started calling it body radiotherapy just to make the distinction. But the immobilization device is a little bit different too.
It seems like the therapy is a little bit longer or different, if I recall from the beginning when you talked about that for the brain tumors. Does that just happen to do with the way brain tumors respond?
You know, we do it in up to 5 fractions in the rest of the body. Some sites we could do in 1, and the brain you could do in up to 5. People, again, different, typically don't, because the head positioning device is often a little bit invasive. Like sometimes it actually gets bolted to the skull, and you can't really put that on 5 times. So the studies come from doing it all in one treatment.
And you've already started doing some of the stereotactic body radiation up here?
Yes.
So what do we know about long-term outcomes? I mean, obviously, as you've said, we must realize that the outcomes are better than not treatment. With using this kind of radiation therapy, what can we tell a patient with, you tell me the lung cancer that you may be addressing, and what kind of information can you give them? And I know it takes a lot of information, is how old are they, where are the metastasis, maybe the cell type. But give me some ballpark ideas of what we're gaining from this.
The local control for tumors that we call T1, or generally 3 centimeters or less, is 90% and better at 5 years, which is much better than it has been with fractionated radiation or even these smaller surgeries called wedge resections. Mm-hmm. With fractionated radiation, it was, you know, maybe 50%, and with wedge resections on the ballpark of 80%. So 90, 95, in some studies even 98% chance of not having the tumor come back in the area where it started. Mm-hmm. So it's excellent tumor control.
Does that also mean that there's a decrease in metastasis likely as well, or is that a different issue?
No, that's a different issue. This is just having it come back in the area that we treated. That's not the same as not having it come back either in lymph nodes between the lungs or in a different place in the body. Mm-hmm. Of course, if the tumor comes back, you know, where it started, then it has a chance of coming back later somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, those are different issues.
With recurrences, can you do the same therapy? Would that be the recommendation?
You can do the same therapy. Doing the same therapy in the same place gets tricky, and not everybody does that. Mm-hmm. But you can. It is possible.
Is there a typical surveillance? Is there a typical what you do after this treatment in way of follow-up to look for the potentials for incomplete therapy or recurrences or metastasis?
Mm-hmm. Typically, we scan every 3 months with a CAT scan. And we often do PET scans as well, although they're a little trickier to follow. And if there's physicians listening, this is a good point to make, because after stereotactic, the response on PET is typically paradoxical for the first 6 months or so. You see an increased uptake on PET before it goes down.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is just tissue repair in the area and increased uptake?
So repair, inflammation, resorption.
Okay. We're kind of into our last minute. I like to always leave an opportunity to kind of summarize what you want listeners to get out of this kind of discussion.
To summarize for listeners, one, the websites, nccn.org for patients is a great site. Patients and Anchorage are lucky to have two fantastic radiation sites, so they really can stay home for their treatment.
Are there things that we are not doing up here now that we can't do from a radiation therapy standpoint? I guess that's one final question that comes to my mind. Are we pretty much can do most things that may otherwise people think they have to go outside to get done?
If we knew of, if there were a technology that we didn't have that we wanted, we would be working on getting it.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate this. This is the first time we've got into quite this much depth, I think, and I think it was very beneficial to me and I'm sure to many of our listeners. So thanks very much, Kara, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to continue some of this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, where you can find links at our new website, alaskapublic.org. And also, why don't you join us next week on November 7th when we return. We're going to be talking about another issue we've never addressed in the 10 years I've been doing this program. We're going to be talking about the uses and abuses of oxygen at higher than normal pressures, hyperbaric treatment, with Dr. Robert Sanders, who's medical director of American Hyperbaric Center here in Anchorage. The use of oxygen as medical therapy is something I have not addressed. I want to thank Pat Yak, who's Vice President of Public Media, Kristen Spack, who's our web editor and audio engineer, and all of you who listened, especially those who took the time to call or email.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.